Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. In the early 1920s, two young men named Bill, living in New Orleans' French Quarter, wrote, illustrated, and had published an intellectual private joke they titled Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, a gallery of contemporary New Orleans. The authors were Bill Spratling, then a professor at Tulane, later to become a noted designer of Mexican silver, and Bill Faulkner, then a young, self-assured fellow from Mississippi working on a drinking habit, later to be Nobel laureate of the American South. This private joke provides, as Spratling later commented, a mirror of our scene in New Orleans, and John Shelton Reed has taken full advantage of said mirror. He's the William Rand Kennan Jr. Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where, among many other things, he also co-founded the Center for the Study of the American South and the journal Southern Cultures. In addition to being a sociologist, even a retired one, you can't apparently stop being one, he's a witty and stylish essayist and a good man to have a conversation with, as I think you'll agree, in about 40 minutes. John, so good to talk to you.
Thank you, Al. Thanks for all those kind words.
Well, all right. Well, I kept them to as brief as I could. I talk about the Colonel Reed and the Reed. Well, so Dixie Bohemia, a French Quarter circle in the 1920s. It's the result of some lectures you gave at LSU, or was it?
Yeah, that's right. I was invited a while back to give the series of lectures at LSU that's been going for 50 years or so. And the nice thing about it is you know, once you agree, you can talk about anything you want.
So,
unless you really disgrace yourself, LSU Press will publish the result. as far as I know, in 50-plus years, they've never refused one. But anyhow, I could pick my subject, and I picked a subject that let me go spend a lot of time in New Orleans doing research.
Yeah, doing serious primary research. Yes.
Oh, yeah, every day.
At Galatoire's and such like.
You understand.
Yeah. So Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, you say that they're, first of all, there's a joke to the title. But first, yes. Before we get to that, who is Sherwood Anderson? Can you tell a benighted 21st century audience?
Yeah, isn't that a claim that I have to ask that question, but you do.
Yep.
100 years ago or so, Sherwood Anderson was being given titles like the Dean of American Literature. He was possibly the best known and certainly one of the most successful American writers of fiction. His best known book, probably Winesburg, Ohio. And in the 20s, he moved for a while to New Orleans and became part of this group that I was writing about. At that point, he was at the peak of his career. He really was famous, though not a Creole. We'll get to that in a minute. And I think literary scholars would say now that at that moment, he was probably at the peak of his powers, and he lived a good deal longer and kept writing, but never again anything as good as what he'd written before that stage. Anyhow, he was a very well-known fiction writer and far and away the best known of the crowd I'm writing about.
Famous Creoles. What's the joke?
Okay. They took the title. It's not a very funny joke, but they took their title from a book published a year or two before by a Vanity Fair cartoonist, a collection of his caricatures called The Prince of Wales and Other Famous Americans. And, of course, the Prince of Wales wasn't an American. Sherwood Anderson was not a Creole. As a matter of fact, the 40-some-odd people in there, only two were Creoles, if Creoles understand that word, that is Louisianans of French or Spanish descent. Hmm. The rest were some of them Louisianans, a good many of them Southerners, but some of them Midwesterners like Anderson, who just happened to wash up in New Orleans. So the joke is that Sherwood Anderson was not a Creole, although he was famous. Many of the others, most of the others were not Creoles, and most of them were not famous by any standard.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of us here are internationally famous locally, which is the kind of fame that many of them had. They were well known in New Orleans.
Yeah. And what's interesting also, I think, about the suggestion is that it uses something that's very exclusive, Creoles. Talk about it is a rather inclusive group that is part of this social scene.
Yes,
the social circle.
It is very inclusive in every respect but one, and we'll get to that.
We'll get to that, yeah.
Yeah, it's all ages. I mean, the youngest was a woman of 20 who was a cheerleader at Tulane. The oldest, I believe, was Grace King, very distinguished local color novelist and local historian, who was, gosh, I don't know, in her 80s probably. Anyhow, there was a considerable range of ages, considerable women were well represented, maybe a third of them, I'd have to count, women. Some were professional people. The president of Tulane was one of them, a couple of working architects of some distinction. Others were just graduates, recent graduates, or in Marion Draper's case, still an undergraduate at Tulane. It was a pretty motley crew. The one thing they had in common was that all of them were friends of William Spradlin, I guess,
yeah.
At least acquaintances of Spradlin.
So before we get to the some of the sociological point you make early on in the book that I want to touch on, we should explain. We know who Bill Faulkner is, although
yes.
We don't know him. Most of us don't know who he is at this point in his life, which is key. This is sort of a moment where he's left Oxford, and it's before he goes back to Oxford. So
that's right.
What's he written at this time? What's
very
he done?
Very little. He wrote a poem. He wanted to be a poet. And he wrote a poem that was published in a little magazine called The Double Dealer that was part of this scene. It was well reviewed by his friends. Sherwood Anderson was a very helpful mentor to him, encouraged him to write fiction instead. He wrote a novel called Mosquitoes, which was based on an episode in the history of this circle. He had Soldier's Pay, another novel. So he was banging it out. He was sat on his balcony with his typewriter and a glass of corn whiskey, and every morning he was up there writing.
Huh. That's pretty much the way he did in
for the rest of his life,
yeah.
Really.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about Bill Spradlin. We talk about Bill Spradlin.
Yeah, Spradlin was the other half of this dynamic duo. He was somewhat older than Faulkner, and in fact, he was Faulkner's landlord in a sense. He rented an apartment and then sublet a room to Faulkner, and they became close friends. They went to Europe together. They moved around the corner to a different apartment together. But Spratling was, at this point, teaching in the architecture school at Tulane, although, in fact, he had not actually graduated from Auburn. He had no degree, but he was a draftsman and an artist. He was aspiring to be a painter and visual artist. He did a lot of sketches of plantation houses and the sketches in this book of his friends, and he painted in Europe when he and Faulkner went over there. But eventually, he wound up as a designer of silver jewelry and flatware, which at which he was a genius. He was much better at that than he was as a painter.
So they're part of this social circle, and you write that a social circle almost always exists in symbiosis with one or more institutions, and this one was no exception.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, let me define what I mean by a social circle.
Sure.
This was not a group in the sense that sociologists use that word. They didn't all know one another. I'm sure that some of them had never been in the same room and never were, but they were tied together by a loose network of friendships. You know, they all knew someone who knew someone, and they sort of hung out. And they all knew Faulkner, Spratling, for starters, and I presume most of them knew Faulkner because he was Spratling's roommate. But this is, when I say they exist in connection with some institutions, I mean that some institutions generally bring these people together in the first place and introduce them to one another. Then after the circle comes into being, it often produces its own institutions that, attract other people to the circle and keep the circle going. In the case of this one, I don't want to get too boring and sociological. I get this out of the way pretty quickly in the book.
But
the case of this one, a lot of the people had Tulane connections, Tulane University connections. Some taught there. A good many were graduates of it. The president was one of them. So Tulane was something that a bunch of them had in common, and that's where a lot of them met one another and Spratling. Another thing that pre-existed the circle was the Double Dealer magazine that I mentioned, a couple of young World War I veterans had founded that. It was very much part of the Roaring Twenties in New Orleans. It published a lot of work by some very well-known people, even though it didn't pay its writers. it was remarkably good magazine. It was, to be sure, often second-rate work by first-rate people. It was stuff that people had in their drawer, but when the Double Dealer wrote and said, "Do you have anything we can use?" They didn't just ignore them. They sent them something out of the drawer. You know? So, anyway, as I said, it published Faulkner's first piece. It published Hemingway's first piece. This magazine existed. A lot of people were connected with it, either as writers for it or editors of it, or somehow or another. They certainly nearly all read it, I'm sure.
And you also mentioned that the other institutions are not just the New Orleans Times-Picayune, but also the Item, the States, and...
Yeah, there were three, and then for a time, four daily newspapers in New Orleans. It was a very competitive newspaper town.
And there's nothing better for writers than a newspaper war.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the ways they competed was intensive coverage of the local scene. So a lot of these people were newspaper people, worked for the newspapers. A lot of them did freelance stuff for the newspapers. Their friends who did work for the newspapers would send $10 their way to do an illustration or to write a little sketch. Faulkner did a number of sketches for the Times-Picayune. This world of journalism was as important as Tulane in bringing people into New Orleans, introducing them to one another, getting this circle rolling. Then after the crowd had assembled there and and other things began to emerge. Some of them founded something called the... I tried for a good while to get my mouth around the French of this, but then I learned that in New Orleans they call it Le Petit Theater. an early community theater that a lot of these folks did set designs for them and painted scenery and acted in their plays, and a number of them wrote one-act plays that were put on by the community theater. That was part of the, very much part of the scene.
And the Arts and Crafts Club.
That may have been the most important thing that these folks created. It had a place on Royal Street and offered lessons, and a number of these people taught there, were paid to teach there. A good many of them were students there. They had annual balls, which were costume balls, which were, they know how to throw a party in New Orleans. So these were great occasions. I've got most of a chapter talking about these costume balls, maybe more than they deserve, but they're such fun. They were having fun. It's fun to read about.
So all these interests, the interests that created these institutions, that perpetuated these institutions, then also created glue for a social circle. That's how this thing works. And then it feeds and creates other institutions, which keeps on, as it were, reproducing the circle. Is that the sort of the process?
Yeah, reproducing it, reinforcing it, bringing in new members. It just keeps the ball rolling.
One of the things I was curious about, and what wanted to ask you as soon as I read the book, and here I have the opportunity, is you make it clear that so many of them were well traveled. They had experienced the Left Bank. They had experienced Greenwich Village. To what sense was this almost like an imitation bohemia that they were creating?
I think quite often it was a very conscious imitation. They liked to compare themselves to Greenwich Village, and in a way it was a sort of best pocket southern version of Greenwich Village. There were some important differences, but that was plainly the model they had in mind, and these costume balls were explicitly modeled on the artist models balls that they used to have in Montmartre. They weren't quite as scandalous as those French ones, but not bad for a provincial southern city in the 1920s.
So who are some other members of the scene? We've got Anderson, we've got Faulkner, we've got Spratling.
I'm trying to think of people who folks might have heard of. And
that probably is impossible.
It may well be. I mentioned Grace King, who was sort of Aminos Greece, whatever the feminine for that is. She was a novelist and historian. I mentioned the president of Tulane. There was a young guy named Hamilton Basso, just fresh out of Tulane, who was working as a reporter, went on to become a writer for Time Life and wrote a novel called The View from Pompey's Head that was a considerable success, I think, in the 1950s. This guy named Rourke Bradford, who did sort of cringe-worthy dialect stories based on the Bible. One of his sets of stories was adapted for the Broadway stage and became, I've forgotten the title. Anyway, a Pulitzer Prize-winning Broadway show with based on the quaint religious views of cast of southern black folk. Rourke Bradford has kind of fallen out of favor, but he was well known at the time. Let's see, who else?
Internationally known locally.
Internationally known locally. And actually, with that Pulitzer Prize in Broadway, he was, there was a demand for this kind of dialect stuff outside the South as well. I mean, as a matter of fact, he tried on a couple of occasions to write novels that weren't about rustic and comic black folks, and they were unsuccessful. He was basically told to stick what he was good at.
Oliver Hazard Perry Lafarge.
Lafarge was an anthropologist, as was Franz Blohm. These were two guys at Tulane in anthropology that did really important pioneering work in Mexico with the Mayans. And some of that, you mentioned those names in Latin American anthropological circles, they're still well respected. Lafarge was also a writer on the side. He was a party boy. I mean, he was very much part of this crazed social circle, and to everyone's surprise, he eventually produced a novel, because a a lot of these folks like to talk about their novels and then went out and drank and danced instead.
Yeah.
But Lafarge produced the novel sort of on his way out the door. He moved back to, he left New Orleans, went back to New York, and eventually wound up in Santa Fe. But he published this novel kind of as he left New Orleans, and it won a Pulitzer Prize.
Another one.
So, some of these people had had real talent, and some of them actually employed that talent. A lot of them wasted it. There's a guy named Weeks Hall who was one of the more stranger and more at this point amusing people. He was an artist, or aspired to be. He owned a plantation in New Iberia called Shadows on the Tesh, which. Many people know it's a National Trust house now, but when he bought it, it was a wreck, and he devoted his life to restoring it and bringing it back to its antebellum glory. It had been built by his great-grandfather. Anyway, Hall, as I say, was colorful in a great many ways. I was recently in New Iberia, and I went to the bookshop at Shadows on the Tesh, and without identifying myself, I said, "Do you have a book called Dixie Bohemia?" And they said, "No, we don't." I said, "Oh, that's funny. I thought Weeks Hall was in it." And the lady behind the counter said, "He is." Evidently, my treatment of Hall doesn't meet with approval in those circles. But I can live with that.
Yeah. Well,
there was a woman named Genevieve Pitot was a concert pianist, had trouble making a living as a concert pianist, so she, for a time, accompanied the fan dancer Sally Rand and wound up on Broadway as a very accomplished adapter and composer for the Broadway stage. Damn Yankees and a bunch of other Broadway shows you've heard of, she worked on. I could go on.
Yeah, we could go on with many other colorful characters. I want to get back to the Maya connection, which I thought said something about New Orleans and its place in the South. But what was life like in the Quarter back in the 20s? I mean, how was this life of their life characteristic and uncharacteristic of the rest of New Orleans?
Right. Well,
a lot of the exoticism to people like Oliver Hazard Perry Lafarge.
Right.
Was just New Orleans exoticism rather than Bohemian exoticism. It's an interesting kind of...
Yeah, this South Louisiana scene is, attracts artists, obviously, and it also attracts writers because there's a colorful life in every... there's folk life, there's sailors, there's all sorts of degeneracy. There's a lot of stuff to write about. But... At the time of World War One, the French Quarter had become a slum. I mean, it was built by these Creole families before the war, the big war, before the Civil War.
Yeah.
But after that, they gradually moved out across to Esplanade Avenue or other neighborhoods, and the houses they built, which is what you see today, became tenements.
Mm-hmm.
And at 1910, by one estimate, 90% of the Quarter's population was Italian, mostly Sicilian, poor, often illiterate Italians were brought in. They worked originally on the docks, and then a number of them went into open small groceries and produce stands and that sort of thing. But you had large families, often with chickens and animals, living in these big houses. So it was on its way down, and there were serious proposals just to level the place and build something modern and sanitary. Fortunately, a number of people recognized that there was something there worth saving, and you had this curious convergence of society ladies on the one hand and artists and writers on the other who discovered that you could move into this amazingly picturesque place and live very cheaply. It was kind of dangerous after dark, but it still is in some places. But it had the makings of the Bohemian. Same story with Greenwich Village, by the way, in North Beach in San Francisco. I don't know what it is about Italian slums that gives rise to bohemians. But it's actually, I have some suspicions about what it is.
What is it? Because I'm from Philadelphia, and I'm not sure that South Philadelphia has created this much of bohemia. But
sure. Well, for one thing, unlike some other ethnic groups I could name, the Sicilians, although they were fairly rigid among themselves, didn't much care what their neighbors did. In fact, they were in New Orleans. They were known to be remarkably easygoing on the subject of race. So that was part of the story. Also, they had nothing but contempt for prohibition laws. This was during prohibition. So, you could buy the makings for every street corner had a little Italian grocery that was selling flavorings for the raw Cuban alcohol that you could buy elsewhere. And, it was a wide open town as far as liquor went, and it was largely the Italians who made it. So, I think you'd have had a rather different experience in a neighborhood populated by Irish or Germans.
Well, the beer would have been better.
I hate to trade in stereotypes, but I've got some quotes in there from New Orleans Sicilians themselves who have some things to say on the subject.
Yeah, I guess the most interesting and incredible thing to me in the book is that no one in the circle that you're discussing seems to like jazz. I didn't know what to do with that.
It's not that they dislike it. In fact, they went out. Some of them went out and danced to it, but and occasionally Faulkner and some of his friends would go listen to this clarinetist. But the point is, there was this efflorescence of jazz all around them.
Yeah.
But when they wanted music, particularly when they wanted, a number of them were classical musicians, and they were interested in classical music. If they wanted music from their African American neighbors, however, they tended to go for the work songs that the stevedores were singing on the docks, or the gospel songs in black churches. In fact, going to black churches to listen to the choir was a frequent occupation for many of these folks.
So this is like a folk music division going on at before Lomax, before even the Elder Seeger. This intellectuals interested in folk melodies rather than in, I don't know what they saw jazz as, but they saw the other thing as more true.
I a number of these folks, Rock Bradford and a couple of others, wrote novels and short stories about black folk life. It's not easy reading these days. It's very condescending, but they were sincerely interested in folkways of their black neighbors. They were kind of blinkered in many ways, but one of them, Emmett Kennedy, collected black songs, did some really valuable work, even though he collected them in order to put on blackface and perform them, which he did at Town Hall in New York. Nevertheless, he collected these songs. Now, I think part of the reason people liked work songs and religious songs was that somehow they were seen as more authentic, more real than jazz, which was kind of throwaway stuff.
Authentic, real, true, something like that.
The impulse I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just fascinating to find it here at that time. You try to put this at the beginning and at the end, but you, the pointy-headed sociology stuff. But this is a podcast called Historical Thinking. So, what's the sociology of bohemias? You go through a sort of, you talk about the natural history and lifespan of bohemias. What's the
conclusion? Because the question arises, why is this not still there? What happened to it?
Yeah.
But it's clear that by 1930 or so, it was over. Most of the people I was writing about had left or moved on to other pursuits, or grown up.
Six or eight years.
And the scene was no longer there, and the quarter was no longer really a place that could give rise to such a scene. And this is not unique to the French Quarter. I mean, the same thing happened in New York and Paris and London. What you have is a neighborhood that's sort of run down and cheap and possibly a little scary, but where artists and writers can afford to live, you know, pursue their work, give them stuff to write about often. They begin to rehab the place, you know, fix things up. Other people who aren't artists and writers come in and open shops and boutiques and coffee houses and things like that, supporting bookshops, supporting institutions. Tourists start to show up and look at the artists and writers and drink in the coffee houses. Mm-hmm. The tour buses start coming. A lot of first wannabe artists and writers show up. Yeah. They're not really serious about their art, but they like to hang out in coffee shops.
The the Fohemians, you call them.
Fohemians, yeah. I didn't coin that phrase, but it's a good one.
Too bad. It sounded like you. All right.
Yeah. No, I used it without attribution because I didn't know whom to attribute it to.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, that's the kind of folks I'm talking about.
Right. And then the old Bohemians start acting like crusty old, you know, veterans of the Confederate veterans, the sons of Confederate veterans. They're complaining.
Yeah, they say, you know, it was great before you got here, you know, which is kind of what the Sicilians said when they showed up, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
natural progression there.
Yeah.
And rents start to go up. You know, people who like artistic environment move in, and they can afford to fix up their places, and they're not living in lofts anymore. If they are lofts, they've been converted and wired and indoor plumbing and all this stuff. Real estate prices go up. Artists and writers can't afford to live there anymore. The tour buses mean that maybe they're not interested in living there anymore anyway. So in New Orleans, what has happened, and it continues to happen, is folks move downriver. I mean, any of your listeners who know New Orleans will know that just downriver from the French Quarter is an area called the Marigny, which is where all the good music is these days. I mean, in the Quarter, you can get sort of fossilized Dixieland and a lot of drunk tourists. But if you want to hear serious music, you go downriver to the Marigny. And that was a bohemian place until recently, although the same process happened. The prices went up, and a lot of people moved in who weren't artists, and now the hot area in New Orleans is just downriver from that, the area called Bywater. It's got all kinds of galleries and hot new coffee shops and restaurants.
So you can see it burning like a fire.
Yeah, it doesn't always move, you know, to a contiguous neighborhood, but it did in New Orleans.
Yeah.
But in London, Chelsea used to be full of bohemians. I mean,
sure.
In the 19th century, it's now full of Russians.
Yeah. Well, Russian oligarchs and their mistresses.
Exactly.
North. I've got a friend who lives near there. So
that's right. Yeah,
it's what was Dixie about this Bohemia? I mean, this I should say to listeners. I mean, this is John Shelton Reed I'm talking to. He's the guy that talked about what's the South. I mean, this is I used to say that. I think you've said to me and many other times that you've had one idea in your life, and it was like what the South is. Or how to answer that question.
What Southerners are, really.
Yeah,
I'm a sociologist rather than a geographer, although I hang out with geographers. But, my notion that I've spent most of my career investigating is that Southerners in many ways are like an ethnic group, groups we more often think of as ethnic. So
like
that raises all sorts of questions about identity and stereotyping and social boundaries and all this sociological stuff. And the answers are interesting because quite often they are like Italian Americans or Jewish Americans, and sometimes they're not. And when they're not, it's interesting too.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, that's my one idea. Getting back to Dixie Bohemia.
Yeah. So, what's Dixie about this Bohemia? How did they self-identify or as?
Right. Well, a lot of the members of this group were Southern, but the ones that weren't largely accommodated themselves to the fact that they were in the Deep South. You know, New Orleans is different, but not in the 1920s. It was not particularly different in matters of race relations. I mean, it was a Jim Crow society. So this group I'm writing about was entirely white, and there were black artists and poets across town at Dillard University, but there was absolutely no communication across racial lines, as far as I know.
And it's what's interesting about that is, as you've made clear, there's a third of the group is female. Women are a third of the group.
Yeah.
A great many of them are openly gay, and that doesn't seem to bother anybody in the slightest.
No.
But it is a lily white Southern group of Yankees and Southerners.
I mean, Oliver Lafarge, we mentioned earlier, came from a New England family, distinguished New England family.
With a name like Oliver Hazard Perry Lafarge.
Lafarge, yeah, that one. He said, he wrote that his Southern friends, you know, asked him what he thought about race relations. You know, and he said that, well, he confessed that he was from the New England abolitionist tradition, but that he was trying to keep an open mind and look around him and learn. He'd only arrived, and that he said that was a perfectly satisfactory answer. And I expect it was. I mean, you know, if you'd started preaching on the subject of race relations, you'd have some new friends in that time and place, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
So, they either supported, many of them with unquestionably and enthusiastically supported the prevailing racial norms, or they acquiesced in them. And Lafarge just kept their mouths shut. And, you know, that's not surprising. You know, we can regret it, but, you know, given the time and place, it was that or nothing. You're going to have a Bohemia. It's going to be all white in New Orleans in 1926.
Yep.
That's how it is.
Yep.
One other thing.
Oh, yeah.
a peculiar aspect of this was they all had servants. I mean, Faulkner and Spratling had a cook.
Yeah, that's right.
And these impecunious artists and writers weren't so impecunious that they couldn't afford help. I think that's an unusual aspect of
it really
this
is.
Bohemia.
I mean, this is not part of La Boheme.
No.
Having servants. I mean, this is pretty incredible where labor is so cheap, you can have a servant.
Yeah.
Why New Orleans? Why? I mean, this is a perennial question in Southern history.
Sure.
How is New Orleans different from all other places? What continues
right.
to keep
well,
it different?
I've spent a chapter or so on that. It's partly it's this fact that it's a port city with a large immigrant population. I've already talked about the Italians. But it also had large, I talk about the importance of the Jewish population in New Orleans, which was quite large. I mean, New Orleans was a big city in Southern terms. I mean, a lot of things it had in common with Charleston, but Charleston was much smaller. So, you know, there just weren't as many Jews, there weren't as many gay men, there certainly weren't as many Italians in Charleston.
Not as many rich people, probably.
And, you know, I've talked about Charleston and Nashville as other places where something like this might have happened, and Charleston did indeed have some serious painters and visual art at the same time here, and Nashville had a literary scene in its own little magazine.
Sure.
But New Orleans was the obvious place for this. The Jewish population was very supportive. I think a half dozen or so of the 40-some-odd famous Creoles were Jewish.
Yeah, they were not segregated by Jewishness or...
The Jewish families in town supported artistic things like the opera and the Arts and Crafts Club and the little theater. So, I mean, that was interesting because I speculated this sort of throwaway line that because they were excluded and they were from the elite Mardi Gras crews, they spent their money instead of costumes and balls and whatnot associated with Mardi Gras. They spent it on cultural institutions. And if you look at the ads of the Double Dealer, for example, the Jewish merchants are vastly overrepresented. Maybe half of the ads in there are from Jewish merchants and professional people. So that's important. It was very tolerant on the subject of, as you mentioned, gay men, and a number of these folks were that, and was never, you know, there's no place in the United States where it was comfortable in 1924,
right.
But some places more comfortable than others. This was one of them.
Yeah, we had to put New York and New Orleans at the top of the list, probably.
Yeah, I would think so. I don't know what was going on in San Francisco at the time. But,
right.
Anyhow, that's...
Yeah, and as also you point out, it's easier to get liquor in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, liquor to this crowd was what marijuana was to a later generation of Bohemians, you know.
Yeah.
It's what you have at parties, and it's illegal, sure, but it's easy to get, and it kind of draws a line around the circle. You know, if you're not drinking, you're not part of this crowd.
Okay. One of the things you conclude on is that, in a way, the greatest success of this social circle and the people associated with the institutions who are not part of the social circle was to facilitate the end to facilitate the restoration of the French Quarter, which both saved it but also ended the Bohemia.
Yeah, you know, that was an accomplishment. You had this strange coalition of Bohemians who wanted to save the Quarter because it was picturesque and a place where they could live their Bohemian life, so they didn't want it bulldozed. And society ladies who didn't want it bulldozed either because it was a sign of New Orleans' gracious historic past. And so they came together to form things like historic, I forget what it was called, but something like the Historic New Orleans Commission. And they got laws passed and ordinances passed to protect some of these buildings, and they mobilized to protect the individual buildings when they were threatened with destruction. There was a fault line there that I write about, but it never really opened up. The society ladies, the uptown ladies, they wanted to bring the Quarter back to its antebellum splendor. So they were interested in cleaning it up, basically getting rid of the squalor, Italian garlic merchant in a shed on the street. That was not part of their vision of the of what the Quarter ought to be. But the Bohemians, on the other hand, kind of liked it, ramshackle and laundry hanging on the porches, and it was real. It was European. It felt like Palermo,
it's authentic.
You could have this exotic experience without leaving the country.
Yeah.
So the two didn't exactly see eye to eye, but the big issue of the time was whether the Quarter was going to be preserved or destroyed, and they certainly agreed on that.
Yeah. We just have a few more minutes left. I wanted to ask in closing, you've committed numerous acts of historical sociology in your lifetime.
Yeah.
Some of which you had a license to do. What sets, for a podcast called Historical Thinking, what sets historical sociology apart from history, as you a sociologist understand it?
Well, I don't see a lot of distinctions. There's a considerable overlap, I think, between historical sociology and social history. I think, the methods are very much the same. I mean, I spent time in archives reading, letters and documents and theater programs and stuff like that. The methods are pretty much the same. The questions may be slightly different. I mean, all this stuff I went on about social circles and institutions, I mean, some historians talk that way, but I think they learned it from us.
Oh, yeah.
What comes to my mind when I look at this crowd is I'm certainly less interested in the quality of the stuff they turned out than a cultural historian would be. I mean, you ask, were these good novels that they were writing? Were these good paintings they were painting? I'm in really no position to say, but
that's not part of your story.
No, it's not. I read people who are in a position to say and take their word for it,
Yeah.
But and it's not particularly important anyway, because I'm curious about the circle they built and the institutions they founded and how this came to be where it was in New Orleans rather than somewhere else. And this business about the natural history of the place and how that's similar to other Bohemians. These, I think, are sociological questions, although other people might well ask them, too. I hope other people do, because if nobody else is interested in them, no one's going to read this book.
Finally, let me ask you a I can ask you this question. You can answer it because you're emeritus now. So
yes.
You know, since the 70s, since basically historians started reading Clifford Geertz and reading the historians who read Clifford Geertz, cultural history is basically in many ways a branch of anthropology. Certainly we take anthropological theory has been tremendously, I can't think of anything more important to the last 25 years of historical thinking. My own personal inclinations are often towards sociology. I guess that's why I ended up reading you. But why, what should historians, what do you think they should be learning from sociologists these days? How should our thinking be shaped by sociology?
Oh, well, you
I know. It's off. And do that in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned that I'm emeritus, so like many old-timers, I think the thing has kind of gone to hell since my day. You know, if you look at the programs of sociological meetings, the number of papers that might be of interest outside the discipline are very small. I actually gave a presidential address to the Southern Sociological Society about this some years back, lamenting that we were more and more writing just for one another, not even for people in other disciplines, you know, let alone for the general public. And you can look at the titles of journal articles from the 1950s, and you read stuff, that the kind of stuff that got me interested in sociology in the first place, the interesting questions. You read them today, and it's either arcanely methodological, you know, mathematical, difficult to understand, almost like physics, you know, or it's
pseudophysics, we should add.
Or it's stuff like what's going on in the humanities, you know, this theoretical stuff. And here I do start sounding like an old timer. It's basically ideological. I don't look to sociology as it exists today for much that's of use to you, because I don't either. historical stuff, Weber and Durkheim, Marx for that matter, the stuff they're worth reading and learning from.
Go back to Weber, Durkheim, Marx, and
rethink the classics. Yeah. And there's stuff from the 50s and 60s that's worth reading too. Robert Merton is good. Talkett Parsons, on the other hand, you can forget about him. He's vanished.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, Al, thank you for letting me run my mouth. I hate to end on a down note like that. But.
Well, you know, we'll talk again soon, and it'll be happier because future podcast, we'll be talking with you and the smart person in the family, your wife, Dale, about barbecue.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'd be good. All right. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Al. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org. where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leinbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.